Well, thank you, Robert and Lucien, for organizing and inviting me to present at this workshop. Well, as you see from the title, yes, I would like to talk about, looking back at the past 10 years of what developments we have seen with the quantum switch. And I'm particularly delighted to give this talk here because this paper on the quantum switch was indeed my first paper as a PI postdoc. So basically it landed on the archive on my first day of employment at PI, just in time to convince some of my quantum information colleagues that I got crazy. So this came out with a very enthusiastic abstract. We submitted this to fancy journals, I guess Nature or Science. We were very excited about this idea that we considered the possibility of combining quantum processes in a superposition of alternative orders. And we are very excited about the implications for computation of that. Unfortunately, the editors of the journals didn't share our excitement, so the paper was published 4 years later with a much more modest title and with a kind of a lower key abstract. So the interesting thing of presenting this 10 years after is that I think that the truth somehow stays in between these two. While this was perhaps overly excited, this was perhaps too little excited. And I hope that the point of my talk today is to come and convey the impression I got in between in these 10 years of like how many things are still very exciting for me and how many things are still open questions. A disclaimer before I get started, despite the title, this is not a review talk. So I try to summarize things that I consider important and that kind of were striking for me. There are a lot of things missing, so do not expect me to give you a full review of the topic, because even just this would take more than 1 hour, probably a couple of even more. So let's get started and let's go into the actual talk. So the plan is the following. I will start from the basic definition and the basic facts about the quantum switch. Then I will talk about its realization with known physics. I will show some information processing advantages that the quantum switch offers. And this is kind of the more review-like part. Then I will talk about two recent developments. One is about the application of the quantum switch to discuss quantum communication and quantum Shannon theory on an indefinite causal structure. And the last is a very new development about the application of the quantum switch in quantum metrology, so a way to get more precise measurements using indefinite causal structure. So, okay, let's start from the first part on the definition of the quantum switch. So the idea is quite simple. So we can, all of the physics we can describe or we are used to describe with quantum mechanics can be summarized somehow in a kind of network of physical processes, a network of quantum processes that are connected to each other. So in this graphical picture, there is the processes are boxes. They have inputs on the left, outputs on the right, and they are connected with each other, with these wires, with these blue wires here. So mathematically, quantum processes are also called quantum channels, and they are maps. They are linear maps that transform density matrices into density matrices. And the way we connect them, so the way the processes stick to each other, somehow the structure of the connection, can be seen as a kind of higher level of map, a higher order map, that transforms channels into new channels. So here the channels, the input channels would be this A, B, and C, and the blue connections combine these three channels together into a new channel, that is the connection of them. So the connection, for the point of view of this workshop, the connection can be used to represent causal structure. And mathematically, well, these maps that connect the channels together, that glue them together, can be used to represent the causal structure. And this idea basically dates back to a fundamental idea by Lucien of the idea of causaloid. So it's the idea of describing the processes that we see locally and having maps that connect the evolution in different regions with the evolution in other regions. So the kind of ideal inspiration came from this work. And the kind of the mathematical framework that we developed to deal with these things is the framework of quantum supermaps. This was a mathematical framework developed later in this work, so starting from basically 2008-2009. So this is about connecting processes and using supermaps, this kind of higher level maps, to describe the transformations of channels and the processes when they are combined together. So let's go to the quantum switch. So let me give you first a simplified quantum switch. That is the one that you see the most in the applications. So the simplified quantum switch is the super map that takes two variable channels, A and B, in input. So these are channels with the same input and the same output, let's say all qubits. And this super map connects the two channels together in a superposition, in a coherent superposition of two alternative configurations. Either A first and then B with a connection linking A and B together, or B first and then A with a connection linking them. So this definition was introduced in the paper I was mentioning at the beginning. So, and most of the things I'm presenting in the first half of the talk are just all from this paper. So that's the simplified quantum switch, the one that connects two processes in a superposition of two alternative orders, controlled by some quantum variable that decides whether A is before B or B is before A. And physically, we can think of that variable somehow as a kind of coarse-grained description of the causal structure. So that variable is itself a kind of quantum instantiation of the causal structure. So here, a more mathematical definition. So if you have your input channels A and B, you can represent them in this operator form called the Krauss representation. And the switch produces for you a new channel, this S of A and B, which can be written in this Krauss representation, where now the Krauss operator of the channel are the ones of A and B connected in the two alternatives way. So either A before B or B before A. All this controlled by a quantum variable, a qubit that we call the order qubit, that decides in which of these two configurations we are. So the quantum switch is a super map, mapping a pair of channels, to stay simple, mapping a pair of channels into a new channel, S of A and B. So this is what you will see in most of the applications, including the ones in this talk. More generally, however, we can also consider networks where we leave some slots open. So here, instead of having a third channel in between A and B, we leave this slot open because perhaps we could plug in it some measurement device or some external intervention. So it's good to have a framework for these things. So it's interesting also to consider networks where we leave some empty slots for channels that for other processes to be inserted. And the full quantum switch is more something like that. So it takes two channels, A and B, and it places them in two configurations with either A before B and the open slot in between, or B before A and again an open slot in between. So this is also defined in the original paper. So there was the original definition of the quantum switch was this one with the open slot. Which is, well, conceptually is not too much different. So if you want to write it explicitly, you will map the two initial channels A and B into a third channel, now where either A is put on the Hilbert space of the system in the first time slot, and then B is put on the Hilbert space of the system on the second time slot, or vice versa. So instead of taking the product of the operator, here we take the tensor product because they still act on independent degrees of freedom that we can access independently. So the quantum switch is the full quantum switch is this super map that maps a pair of channels A and B into this third channel with the open slots in between. Now, is this distinction important between the simplified and non-simplified quantum switch? It's not too important. As I said, for all the applications you will see in this talk, the simplified switch is enough. The only point that I would like to make about the quantum switch is that it is important because by permuting the order of two channels and leaving a space in between, you can generate all possible permutations of n channels. So if you want to permute more than two, you need the full quantum switch to be a kind of a generator of all possible permutations. Whereas if you stick the two channels together, of course, you kind of commit to some type of permutations. So you cannot generate all sorts of possible orders where you have more than two, whereas with the full switch you can. Okay, so that's all about the basic definitions. So let me go now on to some facts about the quantum switch. The most important fact, of course, is that this quantum switch is not compatible with the definite causal order, and that's the reason why I'm talking about it in this conference. So the incompatibility with the fixed causal order is a theorem that can be phrased in this way. It is impossible to find quantum systems and quantum channels C1, C2, and C3 in such a way that the output of the quantum switch, so the output channel of the quantum switch, is equal to this sequence of channels, like C1, then A, then C2, then B, then C3. In other words, it is impossible to generate the quantum switch by plugging the two variable channels A and B into a quantum circuit with a fixed causal order, here going from left to right in the picture. So we proved this, we say you pick an order, let's say A before B, and you show that this is impossible. It's like, if there is a circuit like this, you get into a contradiction. Of course, the proof works also if you swap the order, so if you put B before A, so there is no way to, anyways, to implement the quantum switch in any of these two ways. And since this quantum switch maps unitary gates into unitary gates, it's also easy to say that this proof already tells you that you cannot even get the switch as a mixture of independent orders. So in other words, the quantum switch can be thought as an example of indefinite causal structure. So if you think of these supermaps as the way the channels stick together into a causal structure, this way of sticking together is incompatible with the well-defined causal order. Yes?
The second qubit is the order qubit?
Yes, yes, yes. The second qubit is the order qubit. And for this proof, I'm using the simplified switch. Of course, the simplified switch can be obtained from the full switch. So if the simplified switch cannot be generated in this way, even more, the full switch cannot. So this proves the state and the impossibility for both the simplified and the true and the full quantum switch. All right, a little bit of a glance into the proof, informally, because it reveals an interesting property of the quantum switch. So the proof of this theorem in the original paper was by contradiction. It said that, so let's suppose that you can implement the quantum switch in a sequence, in a well-defined sequence like this, with A before B. Then, if you were to put the order qubit into the state one, ket one, that swaps the order between A and B, and at this point, Rob's clarification is very important, so I do need this order qubit to swap the order. So if I did it, if I plug this here, this should act in the same way as B before A instead of A before B. And what we proved is that the only way that this can happen is that this network of channels has this internal structure, with this informal diagram, meaning that the first input, this green input, is transferred identically to this point. So the system that enters here comes out exactly here. So this is an identity channel mapping the density matrix of the system from here to there. So the purple one is also forwarded straight to the output. And now the weird thing happens with the orange one. So this orange input is mapped back. So the density matrix of the system is basically sent back in time to an earlier time slot. And this is a contradiction, because no quantum channel can do this. If this is the causal structure, if this is the order of the systems, a channel would have to satisfy some normalization condition that is incompatible with this orange line being an identity from the future back to the past. So the way we prove the impossibility is itself revealing something about the quantum switch, that if you could do it, wherever you represent it in this way, every time you represent it in this way, it would contain a sort of backward time loop of this form. And therefore, if you assume that there are no time loops, this is a contradiction. All right, so that was in short, if you can implement a switch in a quantum circuit, the circuit must contain a loop. Interestingly, you can also prove the converse. So if you have access to a magical time loop that takes quantum states back from the future to the past, you can use that to implement the quantum switch. And again, this was also in the original paper, there was this picture showing that if you have access to a time loop, like this loop on the top, then you can just realize the switch with control swap operations and putting the two channels A and B in parallel with each other. So now, what does this diagram mean? Well, we have an expert of what this diagram means here. Alex is one of... Like, these diagrams make clear sense in the language of categorical quantum mechanics. For people in quantum information, these diagrams can be thought just an unnormalized teleportation. You measure here, you have an entangled state there, and this thing acts as like a teleportation from the future back to the past. So a true time loop like this would appear probably, perhaps, in some exotic and very strange regime of quantum gravity. We don't know. We don't really know what physics really holds there. So it could be there, Or more in a more prosaic way, you can simulate this time loop with quantum teleportation with some probability that is not very high, but you can at least simulate this with ordinary physics in a probabilistic way. Okay, one important point to make here is that so the switch was originally defined as a mathematical map, as a map that can be conceivably admitted from a pair of channels to a third channel. So the switch is in the set of supermaps that are the things that are logically conceivable in quantum mechanics. When we ask about the true physics, what is really possible in the world, we are asking a different kind of question. So here I'm saying, if your true physics would allow this time loop, you could realize the switch in this way. The switch is not saying that time loops exist, of course. That's a question about physics, not a question about what is logically conceivable in quantum mechanics. Yes, please.
So here you're talking about simulation, but I presumed in the last slide there was your proof was for no post-selection. Is that correct? Like in the previous...
Oh, if you want to get the contradiction, yes. Yes. Otherwise, I mean, this is a fact. From this you get here. Now, how this is a contradiction, it depends on what are the assumptions that we are throwing in. In particular, if you want no post-selection... Well, what I said, yes, when I said the normalization conditions are not satisfied, I was referring to a scenario with no post-selection.
So if I allow post-selection, this proof idea would no longer work, is that correct?
If you allow post-selection, this picture applies. So you put the Bell state here and the Bell measurement there. So when you are lucky that the Bell measurement gives you the right outcome, condition on that, you do have the quantum switch with probability 1 over d squared, where d is the dimension of the system. Yes?
Can you write the full switch using a picture similar to this one?
I think
some holes or something.
I think so. I should leave holes there. I wouldn't venture in trying to do it now, but I think the answer is yes. You just put enough swaps and holes so that things work. All right, so let's talk about what you can do with the quantum switch. So there are some information theoretic advantages that come from this. The first that came out was in terms of query complexity. So there was a problem of testing properties of black boxes. So the game is the following. I give you two black boxes, A and B. I promise to you that the operators describe these processes either commute or anti-commute. That's a promise that I give to you. And the challenge for you is to discover which one of these two alternatives is the case. And you have to set up your experimental device that tries to distinguish between these two situations. Now, if you have access to a magic physics that gives you the quantum switch, you can discover exactly which property holds in one shot, so using these two boxes only once, and with the probability of error equal to 0, or probability of success equal to 1. So this is what you can do with the quantum switch. Now, it's pretty easy to show that. What is a bit harder is to show that without the quantum switch, so if you fix the order and you restrict yourself to using these boxes only once, then there is no way to distinguish between these two situations without error. So there is always going to be a non-zero positive error that comes out in this problem. And so this can be thought as a kind of first information theoretic advantage of the quantum switch. So this was appeared in this paper of mine with the two channels. Later it was extended by Czaslaw, Fabio, and Mateusz to more than two boxes. So with more than two boxes, you get advantages that are probably likely to be of a, instead of a constant, of being like of a scaling factor. And this is kind of the version for n. So first advantage of the switch is in terms of query complexity, how many times you have to test the boxes in order to discover a property of them. From this, it's very interesting that you can use this idea of distinguishing between commuting and anti-commuting channels. You can use this as a primitive for a very interesting task in communication complexity. This was appeared in this paper by Czaslaw and collaborators. So this is a task where there are three parties, Alice, Bob, and Charlie. They are far from each other. They are given some classical inputs and outputs. So Alice gets input X, Bob gets input Y, and Charlie has to output the value of a function. So the goal of this is to compute a function where the input are given to two people who are far from each other, and the output has to be computed by a third person who is far from the other two. So there are, and the question is like, how much communication do they need to exchange in order for the third party to compute, for Charlie to compute this function? I mean, the obvious way is that that Alice and Bob could just communicate their inputs to Charlie. That's the trivial solution. The question is like, what is the minimum amount of communication that is needed to compute such a function? And in this paper, what comes out is that the author showed that if you assume a fixed causal order where A and B are, well, are in a definite order and they are before C, when this happens, the amount of communication is linear in N, where N is the size of the inputs of X and Y. Instead, if you use the quantum switch, you get an exponential advantage from N to log N bits. Sorry, this should have been a big omega. So you need at least the number you need grows like N, whereas in the in the case of the switch, you only need the order of log N bits. So this is a pretty exciting result because it gives you an exponential separation between the amount of communication you need in one case and the amount you need in the other case. And I would say these two advantages in query complexity and communication complexity really stimulated the experiments of people say, let's try to go to the lab and let's try to see these things in the lab, to see somehow to see this information processing value of the switch in the lab. To do that, you have to realize the quantum switch if you want, or to have to realize something that looks like the quantum switch in the lab. And well, as far as I know, in the lab, we don't have access to exotic physics. So the physics we have has a well-defined causal structure and a well-defined time that flows. So what has been done in the experiment is mostly to realize, well, is actually to realize the output of the quantum switch, to build a channel that has the desired form and exhibits the desired properties, although it's not quite building the super map of the quantum switch. So there have been many experiments. There's a very exciting landscape of photonic experiments with different techniques and also proposal for non-photonic experiments. So it's a very, this was for me one of the most exciting aspects of this research, to see that it really stimulated work by experimental groups. So here I show one of them, one of the experimental setups. Not that all the experiments are equal to each other. So this is one of the early experimental setups. So you can see there is a photon source. A single photon comes out of the source, splits on two paths. The path, one path goes over the unitary gate U, which is a kind of a polarization shifter. And then it goes through the other unitary V, or the other path goes the other way around. And eventually, the two paths interfere again in a beam splitter, and they are measured in the end. So what this experiment and all the other experiments do is to realize the output of the quantum switch. So they generate a channel where the path accesses the order qubit that controls the order of two gates that act on the polarization, or in this experiment on the polarization, in other experiments on other degrees of freedom. So what you realize in the experiment is this channel. This channel, the experimental setup realizes this channel. And as a matter of fact, you can say that these experiments are a successful implementation of a superposition of causal order. You can say that this channel is a channel where U and V appear in a superposition of two alternative orders. So experiment did realize, in my opinion, a superposition of causal orders of two gates. Although on the other hand, we cannot say that they quite realize the quantum switch as a supermap. But if you want to write a schematics of this, of what an experiment does, it does that, well, there are these two boxes that are sitting in the lab at two different times. And the first time, either the vacuum or a single photon enters in one of the two boxes. And the second time, the box that gets the vacuum gets a single photon. The box that got the single photon gets the vacuum, so they're swapped. So in this way, you can reproduce the same output of the quantum switch by using some extended boxes that act not only on the single photon itself, but also on the vacuum. So by using extended unitaries, and by using some a coherence between the vacuum and the single particle subspace. So this is what the experiment actually does. And of course, it requires also coherence in time, because you have to make sure that the same unit, the unitary utilde in the first step is equal to the unitary utilde in the second step, which is actually something that requires some effort also experimentally to guarantee. So this is how I think the experiment can be modeled. It's not quite the quantum switch because it has different input resources, but it produces the same output as the quantum switch. This is in the case of unitary gates. If you want to do it for more general channels, it's even clearer which kind of resources you need in the lab. If you want to do it for general channels, you need to extend to have interactions with an environment, and very crucially, this interaction should preserve the state of the environment whenever you send the vacuum through. So this is quite different from the original quantum switch where you put channel A and channel B here. Instead of channel A and channel B, here you have these two networks, the red and the green network, with a pretty interesting structure in there. So this realization appeared in this recent paper of myself and Claire Christiansen. There is a related paper by Ognian that was published quite recently as well, where there are other schemes other than this one that realize this, again, the same output of the quantum switch by inserting different types of resources in it. So the point I wanted to make here that has been discussed several times, and I think that's my take on this point, is that there are different ways to realize the same output of the quantum switch, and some of them are radically different. So the one with the closed time-like curve, here you really see the two channels A and B and nothing else. And the one that describes more like the experiments we do with ordinary physics, you see the same output, but a supermap of a different type. Instead of taking channels in input, it takes this channels with the two time steps, and two of them are used. And so the red channel here replaces the original channel A, and the green channel here replaces the original channel B. Okay, so this is about the physical realizations with the known physics, with the definite causal structure. So let me go now to the kind of the new directions that we have started considering in the last 2 years. So the first is to think about communication or Shannon theory on in an indefinite causal structure. So long story short, Shannon theory, or classical Shannon theory, was defined by Shannon, his seminal work. So this is the theory that we use for our everyday communication. States are classical, messages are strings of bits. Communication channels are classical, so they map bit strings into bit strings with some probability, some conditional probability. And the configuration of these channels between the sender and the receiver is also a classical configuration, it's well defined. As the original picture from Shannon shows here, there is a very clear causal structure in the different steps of the communication. Quantum Shannon theory is the quantum extension of the original theory by Shannon. It allows the messages, the information carriers and the channels to be quantum. So not only strings of bits, but now we also have superpositions of strings of bits. And there are amazing things we can do with these things. Probably the most spectacular is quantum cryptography. You can distribute a key securely if you allow your messages to be quantum. Still, even quantum Shannon theory is conservative in one respect, in the respect that the configuration of the channels between the sender and the receiver is fixed. And in principle, as we have seen with the quantum switch, we could consider a scenario where the configuration is indefinite itself. So this is what we wanted to do. We wanted to somehow to port Shannon theory from the original causally well-defined scenario to a scenario where we have a superposition of orders. The scenario is that Alice and Bob are embedded in a space-time, let's say, in a background, where the communication resources, the channels in between them, are connected in a superposition of alternative ways. So they are placed, so these two channels, C1 and C2, are placed in between Alice and Bob in a superposition of two ways. This superposition, as I said at the beginning, is represented by the quantum switch. So the switch supermaps is meant to be a description of the causal structure, of the superposition of causal structure. The question we had was, how is the exchange of information affected? So to ask this question, you had to lay down a bit of formalism. So you can imagine that the communication devices used by Alice and Bob are N channels, so these are channels that connect different points. And now the quasar structure determines how the inputs and outputs of these channels are related to each other. So it could be that these channels are placed in parallel, so all the inputs are in Alice's hand and all the outputs are in Bob's hand. Or the quasar structure could decide to place these channels in a sequence, for example, in this way. So mathematically, all these ways that the channels can be placed between Alice and Bob correspond to different supermaps. In particular, we have a placement, a parallel placement is just tensoring the channels and placing them between Alice and Bob. And then there is a sequential placement where you can put the channels in a sequence, possibly with some intermediate operation that serve as repeaters in between. So the idea of this work formally was to add the quantum switch, so to add the superposition of order to the possible placements that are allowed in our theory of communication. So we did it. So basically we had two different models of communication, the one without switch and the one with the switch. So the model one was a parallel and sequential placement only. So that's the only ways that the channels can be laid down between a sender and receiver. The second model is parallel sequential plus a superposition of order. And there is a series of results that show kind of advantages of the second model with respect to the first, like extra power that you get when you are able to superpose the, when the channels are placed in a superposition of orders. In particular, you can communicate with channels that in normal conditions would give you zero communication, both classically and for quantum bits. So these are the results that came out from this area of research. So really the causal structure can serve as a resource that changes a lot the phase of the communication between sender and receiver. So this work stimulated a lot of discussions on a new resource theory of communication, not necessarily have anything to do with causal order itself. So there has been a kind of revived interest in models of communication where sender and receiver can send information along a superposition of paths, and also other models where you can create encoding and decoding operations that are themselves in a superposition. So this was kind of a spin-off, let's say, of this study of quantum Shannon theory with superposition of orders that went beyond the question of indefinite causal structure. And recently we tried to lay down a general framework for these theories, even beyond the causal structure, in this paper that appeared on the archive two months ago. That's all I wanted to say about the quantum Shannon theory with indefinite causal structure. So I would like now to finish with the last and most new application. This appeared on the archive on this Friday. It's about what you can do in quantum metrology, in the estimation of parameters, if you have access to the quantum switch, or more generally, if you have access to indefinite causal order. So it's very nice to finish with a very classic problem. And many times you can say that in quantum mechanics, it's very easy to end up going back to the harmonic oscillator. So let's go back to the harmonic oscillator. Imagine that there is an oscillator with a position and momentum operators x and p, and the kind of canonical Hamiltonian x squared plus p squared over 2, determining the energy. So as you all know, the canonical commutation relation is like x commutator with p proportional to the identity. In my units, we have just the imaginary unit and no constant. Equivalently, in a nicer mathematical form, the commutation relation takes the vile form. If you displace the position and displace the momentum, it's the same as displacing the momentum and the position and putting a phase in front. So here you get the phase that is the product of the amount of displacement in position and in momentum. So this relation between displacements is equivalent to the canonical commutation relation. And we will elaborate on this now. So this phase that you have in the commutator between displacement in position and displacement in momentum is basically a phase space area. It's like the product between x and p is the area of the square you get if you first displace in x and then in p, or instead you first displace in p and then in x, so you get the square. The area of that square is x times p. So now what is the problem that we consider, the metrology problem we consider? It is the following. So you have a harmonic oscillator, and there is a sequence of displacements. So you know that there are like n pairs of black boxes. One black box would be a displacement in position. The other black box in the pair is a displacement in momentum. And there are n pairs like this. The goal is to estimate what is the average displacement in x times the average displacement in b. So what is the average phase space area that is associated to these two sequences of displacement in position and in momentum. So here you have the uniform average of the displacement in x, the uniform average of the displacement in p. You want to know what is the product of these two averages. Canonical question in quantum metrology is like, how well can you do it? How does the precision of the estimation of this quantity, of this product in this case, how does the precision scale with the resources and with the parameters of the problem? What I will care the most is how the precision scales with n, with the number of terms we have when we compute the average. So how does it do it? Okay, let's see a few easy strategies. So the naive strategy is just to try to measure each displacement independently. So you have this n black boxes, so 2n black boxes, n displacement in x and n displacement in p. Now you prepare 2n probes, 2n oscillators. Each one goes through one displacement and you try to guess, to make a measurement, and you try to estimate how much was the displacement. After you have an estimate for all the 2n displacements, you compute the products, you sum them, divide by n squared, and this should be the average area. It's relatively straightforward, using techniques from quantum metrology, to show that, I made a mistake here. So to show that for a single displacement, for the estimation of a single displacement, the root mean square error must be larger or equal, than this quantity, square root of number of times you do repeat the experiment and energy of the probe that you use. So the more energy you invest, the better an estimate you get. If you fix the energy, this is a constant, and you see that there is a square root scaling with the number of repetitions of the experiment. So for every of the 2n displacement, you have an error like this. Now, if you measure these 2n displacements separately, and then you just compute the product, the propagation of errors tells you that the error you get on the average area is going to scale like square root, 1 over square root of number of times you repeat the experiment and number of terms in the average. In terms of the number of terms, this is the standard quantum limit. It's 1 over square root of n. It's a sort of so-called classical scaling that we have here. No surprise, this was a naive way. So can we do better? Sure, we can do better even with the definite causal order. If you take another strategy with the definite causal order, you just apply all the displacement in x on the same probe and all the displacement in p on the same probe. If you do that, the average displacement you get for both average x and average p scales like 1 over n. Okay, this is a bound, but it scales at best like 1 over n. So then if you use the two average displacement, you have an estimate for the average x, an estimate for the average p. The two estimates have error 1 over n. If you combine them together, you still get error 1 over n by propagation of the errors to the product. So this 1 over n is the so-called Heisenberg limit in terms of the number of terms you have in the average. And this is what you can get with this estimation strategy. All right, so these were two special type of strategies. Question is like, how well can you do with an arbitrary strategy where the order is well defined? So what we did was to prove a bound. But if you consider the most general strategy with arbitrary auxiliary systems, arbitrary interactions, arbitrary input states, arbitrary measurements, arbitrary choice of the order in which the displacements are probed, you do this, whatever you get, you cannot get an error that scales better than 1 over n with the number of terms in the average. So the scaling that I showed you in the previous slide, the one you can get by estimating the average x and the average p, is basically already optimal for definite causal structure. So no causally ordered scheme can have a scaling better than this Heisenberg scaling with respect to n. Of course, what happens if you do the quantum switch? The whole point was to show that we have an advantage here. The whole example was constructed on the fact that the switch can test the commutation relations between two different channels. So what we do here is to have to take the sequence of all possible displacements in X and all possible displacements in P and put these two sequences in a superposition of two alternative orders. So either all the X first and then all the P, or all the P first and all the X then after. So you get this in the quantum switch. So you get the order qubit that decides whether you displace first in X or then in P. And here there is some state of the probe of the system that goes through the harmonic oscillator. So this state is unspecified here, just psi. So if you use the Weyl commutation relations, you get that since this displacement commutes up to a phase, this phase is kicked back to the cube, to the order qubit, and appears here with the n square in front. So basically, the order qubit is shifted by an amount that is the area times n square. And now, if you use this, you can see that for small areas, for very small areas, the kind of precision you can get with the quantum switch has the super Heisenberg scaling, 1 over n squared instead of n. That can be contrasted with the 1 over n scaling that you get for fixed causal order, for arbitrary strategies with fixed causal order. There is a bit of a little drawback here, is that since this phase, since the phase is a periodic, well, since this quantity is periodic, well, so what happens here is that for when A increases, this wraps around 2 pi. So you can say, okay, for the phase here, for to get this this scaling, you need the phase, the area to be very small. Or alternatively, you can look at this problem where you just try to estimate the phase itself. You want to estimate the sum of the x displacement in x times displacement in p mod 2 pi. So what we can do with the switch is that you can estimate this quantity with error going like 1 over square root of nu, where nu is the number of repetitions of the experiment. So constant over square root of the number of repetitions. If you instead you have a causally ordered strategy, you will have n divided by square root of nu. So this n, so instead of having this, you are basically multiplying this 2 by n square, and you get this. So basically this tells you that if you want to estimate the phase in a definite order, you need to repeat the experiment a number of times that scales like the square of the number of variables in the sum. So either way, there is an advantage of the switch over arbitrary strategy with definite causal order. This is of course interesting. It's interesting to see if this has applications. Obviously, one application is the application to the test of canonical commutation relations. So in my talk, I just have been lazy. I wrote the canonical commutation relation with just I times identity. In reality, there is like h bar, or there is some constant that will depend on the system under consideration, how you build your harmonic oscillator. So this technique can be seen as a kind of improved measurement strategy to measure the constants that appear there. And it's also interesting in quantum gravity, where there are some alternative theories where there are modifications of the canonical commutation relations. So one can use also these techniques in principle as a way to test modifications to the canonical commutation relation and see what are the small deviations from the exact canonical commutation relation. Something that is challenging, of course, is to see how to implement the quantum switch experimentally on a harmonic oscillator. This is something that I would love to see. I would love to see it done, but it doesn't. It looks challenging. The most obvious way one can imagine to reproduce the quantum switch here would be to think of a massive particle, like I don't know, a molecule that has some internal degree of freedom that is harmonic oscillator, like the vibrations of the molecule. So use the vibration of the molecule as the oscillator, and the path of the molecule as the control. So to use the simulations of the output of the quantum switch that I showed before in the case of a vibrational modes of a molecule. Another way to do this is to use ion traps, where you can control, you can decide to control the amount of displacement with the spin of the ions. You have displacement in the axial mode of the ions, and the displacement was controlled by the spin. In that way, there is also a way to map that problem into the output of the quantum switch, and thereby to obtain some advantage here. Interestingly, I don't know of an implementation of the I don't know of an implementation of the quantum switch on harmonic oscillators that are themselves photonic systems. The problem there is that for the photons, you have the vacuum already, and the vacuum is one of the states of the probe itself. So you cannot use the strategies that I showed you before, where you have extended gates acting on the system and the vacuum, because the vacuum is already part of the system. We would need a third, an orthogonal state, like the abstract vacuum that is orthogonal even to the zero photon states. And in the physics that I know, this is a bit challenging. So my best hope to see this realized, I would say, is now is on kind of massive harmonic oscillators, massive particles implementing harmonic oscillators. So that's all I wanted to say. So I leave you with a few take-home messages. This is a summary of the main points of this talk. First, this was about the definition of the quantum switch, simplified and non-simplified version, with the connections and with the hole in between. These are the definition of the quantum switch. The second point was the relation between the quantum switch and the time loops, kind of this hidden relation that is inside the definition of quantum switch. Third, we talked about the information processing advantages of the quantum switch. So this was query complexity and communication complexity. Here, one can prove this advantage of indefinite causal structure over definite causal structure for two interesting problems. The second point was about the realizations that we can have with the ordinary physics we know, where time is well defined and causal structure is well, global causal order is well defined. So what we can do is to reproduce the same output of the quantum switch with different resources in the input. And this is a way to build actually indefinite causal order in the lab and to create processes where different gates act in a superposition of orders. So the fifth point was to discuss about how the theory of Shannon's theory of communication gets modified if you place communication channels in a superposition of orders. And we have seen that having a placement in a superposition of order gives advantages over the standard placements where the order is well defined. And finally, I showed you this example of application of indefinite causal structure in quantum metrology, where we found this super Heisenberg scaling for the estimation of the phase space area of a harmonic oscillator. So in the simple presentation, this is a 1 over n square error, an error decaying quadratically instead of linearly in the number of terms in the average. That's all I wanted to say, so thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, thanks, Julio. We have time for a few questions. Yeah, Fabio first.
So, going back to your interpretation of the experiments as the realizing as two time steps. Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of things. So I mean, I'm wondering why you think this is the correct representation of the experiments, and I have 2 points. One is you say that for realizing the experiments, it's necessary to have coherence with the vacuum, and I'm quite sure that's not true. I'm sure for 2 reasons. One is that there is an explicit representation of the experiments with of the output of the switch using a circuit, but without using coherence with the vacuum. So you can have a circuit where you use swaps, but you don't swap with the vacuum.
I mean, that circuit is in our original paper.
Huh?
That circuit is in our original paper. So I know about that. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But that's not what the experiment do.
So I'm pretty sure that's not true. So I would like to think about a practical way to test it, to insert a defacing channel between vacuum and not vacuum. Because the point is that this is not like an ordinary, it's not like an interferometer where you have interference between particles going left and right, where you need explicitly the relative phase with the vacuum.
Yeah, I think I already answered. I think I already answered the question. Maybe you haven't finished the formulating it, but I think I have answered the question already.
The main point is that the experiment is insensitive to the relative phase with the vacuum. So if you randomize it, you will not have any difference. And maybe to finish, the question is, why do you think that this two time step realization is the correct one, considering that in practice you can have experiments where you have the coherence length of the photon is much longer than the
path? That's a funny thing. I think that's a confounder. I mean, there are experiments we make the coherence length longer so that you cannot really say which process we go through first. But that's the same as saying that if you start my breakfast and during the breakfast, I also drink water, the two actions are in an indefinite causal order.
Yeah, but
I mean, of course, when things are extended in times, there are situations where you cannot phrase the problem in that way.
Like,
but the interesting part is when you can do it.
So why do you think that the 2-time step is the correct representation, not the n time steps? It will give you exactly the same thing and a more precise representation of the physics, because you have this thing going on through the whole time.
I think, I mean, for the simple discussion we had here, I think this is indeed the clearest representation of the physics. If you want to do that, I agree one can do it. One should do it, but we shouldn't discuss it without doing it. I mean, there should be, this is the representation, like, what is your description of the devices? And then there should be a very long quantum comb with infinitely many little steps intertwined with each other. Yes?
It's modes, physics, crystals, I mean, there is quantum fields if you really want to be serious. This is anyway a schematic representation, so why do you prefer these schematics to the other schematics?
Oh, these schematics, I think, very well reflects what we know that happens in the lab. There are two pieces of glass sitting here. Either a photon is going here, single photon state of the electromagnetic field going here, and the vacuum going there, or vice versa. And that's what the picture is saying.
That's the same as the one user describes. It's
the same output. It's the same output.
Okay, I think
it's not the same result.
Maybe we could let others cancel out and then draw.
I mean, same output we can achieve in many different ways depending on resources.
Yes.
Even in a definite causal order,
yes,
you have one of the boxes.
Absolutely.
And so on. So, but we think that this representation of physical realization is something maybe better, more interesting than the causally ordered scenario. Now, if I, please correct me,
yeah,
if I understood what you said the one with the time loop, mm-hmm, is the mathematical switch, that this would be a physical representation of the mathematical switch, and this is something which has the same output.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you also said that this physical representation is in an example of an indefinite causal structure, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh yeah, I did say.
So according to you, why would this be an indefinite? Because if you look at the circuit of the representation,
mm-hmm,
it looks very causal.
Yes. Yeah.
So
I think I didn't read this sentence. I think you gave me the chance to read it. So the photon, what we call the single photon, experiences the processes U and V in a superposition of two orders.
So what would be the formal definition then of indefinite causal order? What would be the formal definition of indefinite causal order according to you, which would include also physical realization of switch as such?
That's a good question. I wouldn't know how to phrase it mathematically. I mean, I see that people are very excited about these things of the experiment, as if these were the most important thing about the quantum switch.
No,
it may be or may not.
No.
I haven't really spent so much time formulating in which sense the experiment is really a superposition of orders. I'm happy to concede that. Let's put it in this way. My gut feeling is that we can say that the experiment is a realization of indefinite causal order in this sense. In the sense that the experience... It's very poetic. It's not really a mathematical statement, but from the point of view of the photon, I would say this is the experience of the two processes in a superposition, whatever this means. And maybe the work you have been doing on reference frames for different observers could make a kind of more mathematical form for this intuition. The point I wanted to make here is that the switch was defined as a mathematical map. A mathematical map is defined by its types. What is the type of the input? What is the type of the output? The type here is not the type of the map we define. The output is the same, the type of the map is different. And so that's the point that I think should be digested somehow at this point.
Okay, we don't want to get too far,
yes,
behind, so I'll Rob and then here and then that's it.
So I'm not going to ask you about the experimental implementation of the problem. So as you know, in quantum foundations, there's a, you know, a lot of people study the connection between information processing and foundational principles.
Mm-hmm.
And in some circumstances, like where we're talking about the Pescu-Wurlick boxes, you know, we might say, look, a good reason to rule them out and try to come up with axioms that will get us to quantum theory,
mm-hmm,
are that the information processing advantages, if you had such a thing, are unreasonable. Like, you know,
mm-hmm,
communication complexity becomes trivial. That's,
mm-hmm,
unreasonable.
Yes.
The axiom is no trivial communication complexity. Maybe,
yes,
we can derive quantum theory. So what I'm wondering is, do you think it's possible that quantum switch is so powerful that we might discover some information processing task where we want to say, that's unreasonable, and now what we have is a good reason to rule out indefinite causal
order? That's a very good point.
And in particular, why isn't it the case that with your, you know, depolarizing channels, why didn't you look at that and say, well, that's so unreasonable? I'm not saying it is, but you know, like, what on what grounds do you say that that is not so unreasonable that it becomes a reductio against quantum switches?
Again, I don't have a strong opinion on that. Even in the works on Popescu-Rohrlich boxes, I'm interested in these theorems, not much because they convince me that something is very unreasonable, but more because, I mean, the fact itself, we know that a certain two certain properties are related together. No? Having access to non-locality gives you fantastic speed-ups in communication complexity. Having access to the switch gives you advantages in other tasks. I'm more interested somehow in the theorems themselves than in what opinions we should draw on them. But I agree with you that there may be a point where we find advantages that are so big that we decide that, okay, this would be too much. But however, it's very hard to find the compass to decide what things is too good, you know? Like, based on what is the foundation for those judgments anyway? When people say, if this happened, that communication complexity would collapse. Well, this is for the physics to decide, no? It's not, I mean, it could be that it is, no? So I don't have a strong compass for this.
One last one.
Yeah.
I think I will not ask it because it's going to eat up time from my own talk. So I guess.
Okay.
So next speaker, his own question. Let's say Julio.
Okay, thanks. And thanks for the next speaker.